Welcome to the A-Dub Club, a podcast about sci-fi, fantasy, technology, pop culture, the internet, and general nerdery. There are three things that are important to know. One, we occasionally use swear words, but try to stay in the range of PG-13, or at least the kind of R the cool parents are fine with. Two, we may talk spoilers. In this particular episode, we discuss the 2016 movie Arrival, so be warned. And finally, three, most importantly, when I say non-causal a lot later in the show, and I'm talking about causality and things like that, what I really mean is deterministic and determinism. So aka the idea that things are still causal, but all of those causal links are predetermined due to the laws of nature and physics, etc. This is not a fun fact. This is just me abusing the fact that I edit this show to make me seem like less of an idiot than I sounded like in the moment. Anyway, with that out of the way, welcome to the clubhouse. We have snacks. Welcome to the A-Dub Club. My name is Andrew Whipple.
I'm Alex Wade.
And here we are, the second quarantine cast. How are you holding up in our current state of everything?
Well, I tried to get a foster cat and learned that they're out.
Hey, that's very cute. Yeah, oh my
not
gosh.
Good for me though.
No, but that wow, that's really exciting though.
Yay! So if good for no cats needing homes. Now I get to be more lonely. That's whatever. It's fine.
Well, yeah. I mean, the cats will still keep getting born eventually. So that is great though. Good on you for at least wanting to try and foster a cat.
It was for purely selfish reasons.
Hey. You know, I'm sure if there was a cat that existed that was available to be fostered, they would have appreciated it as well. But that's not what we're here to talk about. And in fact, we are not explicitly here to talk about the coronavirus pandemic, which is an exciting breath of fresh air compared to last episode and compared to probably a lot of other podcasts you're listening to. But what we are going to hear to talk about today is we're going to go take a look into the recent past and ask, hey, Alex Wade, what did you think about the 2016 movie Arrival?
Yeah. To be clear, this is a podcast only about my opinion. This is not about Whipple's opinion at all.
It's true. After this point, it's just going to be a one-sided monologue.
I really enjoyed the movie. I have some gripes, mainly to do with the amount of like cliches and character cliches, I guess, that were littered throughout the movie. But also, that's not what the movie was about. It's kind of my general highline take is there's a lot of cliches in the movie, but that was excusable because of the purpose of what I think the movie was trying to do.
Nice.
How about you?
I fucking loved it. This is one of the best movies I've seen in a while. I thought it was incredible. I was admittedly a little bit nervous going into it because the other thing I'm going to throw down on you, Alex Wade, is that before this week, I'd only ever seen one other movie by Denis Villeneuve, who's the Canadian director of Arrival. Yeah. He had also directed Blade Runner 2049, which I saw and really, really loved.
Oh.
I adored that movie. But anyway, I decided that since I'm going to be staying inside for the foreseeable future, that I would watch as many of his other movies as I could over the course of this week. So I watched four other of his movies.
Oh my God.
And as I was watching through them, I was like, oh, these are good, but I don't love them the same way I love Blade Runner 2049. And then that got me also worried, like, did I really love it as much as I thought I did? Because I've never seen it since 2017. Sure. I only saw it once. I only saw it in theaters. That was like 2-3 years ago. What am I going to think about Arrival? I saved Arrival for last. And then I watched this movie and I was like, oh, okay, this movie's fucking incredible and I love it so much. I can see why everyone fell all over themselves to praise it. Though I can also see why people might not love it as much. And I think we'll probably definitely get into some of your gripes. I have some gripes as well. And I think it's that kind of movie where I love it and I think I feel justified in how much I love it. But I could also very easily see a lot of different ways that people could not like this movie and also be right about it. So,
yeah, I do have some some minor complaints that, like, it's like I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I wish I had seen it in the movie theaters. I think I would have loved it if it was in theaters, and like all my gripes would have just been like, sure, they exist, but like the sheer awe that was inspired throughout the movie, that was I feel like the theme of the movie was the awe inspiring sensibility that kind of it really grabbed you at, which is, you know, something that in theaters is really a lot more effective. Yeah.
So spoiler-free context on the movie, if in case you haven't seen it, Arrival, it's a movie from 2016, directed by Denis Villeneuve, who's a French-Canadian director. I guess I can look this up. This is his, I think it was his fourth English language film and eighth film overall. Yes. So before Arrival, had directed movies like Prisoners with Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman. Sicario was sort of, I think, his biggest film. Yes. Right before Arrival. And then afterwards, he directed Blade Runner 2049 in 2017 and is going to be directing the adaptation of Dune that's coming out this December.
Oh, snap. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. I have feelings about that.
The movie came out in 2016. It is based on a short story or a novella, I think, called The Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang. The movie has Amy Adams in the lead role, alongside Jeremy Renner and Forest Whitaker and Michael Stuhlbarg, who I love Michael Stuhlbarg all the time. We'll talk about that more. Spoiler free, I guess the setup, or if you don't want to know literally anything about the movie other than it's good, I guess you can stop here. But stuff you would learn if you had watched the trailers is Amy Adams plays Louise Banks, a linguist, and when a whole bunch of mysterious, seemingly alien spaceships land and float above 12 different sites across the world, the U.S. Army brings her in to help them figure out how they can communicate with those aliens, and then the movie continues on from there. Yeah, a very sci-fi, First Contact, Close Encounters of the Third Kind type dealio that you're getting into, directed by Denis Villeneuve.
It's a very cool movie.
Yes.
I'd give it an A-, personally.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think I would give it an A to A+. I love the website Letterboxd, which is a place for like tracking and ranking and making lists of movies and stuff like that. Highly recommend it. It's the only social network that isn't terrible. So I ranked it as a 5 out of 5 stars on Letterboxd. It's definitely towards the lower end of that, but that's like, oh, it's in the lower end of like, I guess, my 100 favorite movies I've ever seen. So,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think I liked it. Caveat that I haven't rewatched it. I liked it more than Blade Runner 2049, which was already one of my like, oh, this is one of my favorite movies I've ever seen. Yeah. But similar was sort of the bottom of the end. So yeah, A to A+, maybe more on the A side for me.
Okay, cool. Now let's, I guess, get into the spoiler part.
Nice. Cool. Anything in particular you want to start off with before we just start walking through the movie? Any high level spoilery things or things you want to start tick us off with?
Well, I mean, I do want to start with the very beginning of the movie. It starts off with this story, this like lovely vignette of Amy Adams and her daughter growing up and then dying of some disease when she's like a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a nice short, like 3 to 5 minutes, I think, vignette. And I thought it was beautiful, and it really I started to tear up a little bit. But at the same time, I knew that like it was a very not cheap, but couched. Like I, for some reason, my brain was working in like the kind of artistic perspective of like what is the value of this? Like what is, why did this they choose to have this at the very beginning, and what kind of notes were they trying to hit at? I don't know. I feel like I was thinking about it more academically than I was enjoying it for, unfortunately. I don't know why I started off in that kind of mindset, frankly.
Yeah, I could see it as both that, I mean, we knew that we were going to be watching this for a podcast. And like, I also was like, okay, unlike all of these other movies that I've watched this week, I'm going to try and put my phone away. I'm going to like actually pay attention to the movie and stuff like that. But I do think also an overall thing with Denis Villeneuve that at least I've found is there is a level of like, they're cerebral, but they're cerebral in an, his movies are cerebral in an interesting way that like
that. Yeah.
They do make you want to think and analyze. It's not 100% that it's like fully, these are just movies to watch and analyze. He definitely is also very good at like making things tense, getting you invested, getting you in the moment.
I was emotionally hit by that initial thing. Like I absolutely felt the emotion of it, but for some reason it was couched in this thinking. Honestly, for me, that kind of set off a lot of my different feelings about a lot of the cliches in the movie of like this short vignette, while very well done, very powerful, also did feel a bit like, oh, we're trying to give this character something to some sort of sense of loss or some sort of tragedy in her background was kind of like the mind. Like I could see the director or writer being like, this is what write me something that makes you sympathetic to this woman because she, I don't know, lost her child or something like that. Right.
Totally.
Which bled over into a lot of different other things into the movie of like, I guess to kind of move slightly past this of like the military guy, the first scene you met him, this was Forrest Whitaker, you kind of were, he was, oh, gruff and like, oh, it's going to be my way or the highway. You ain't getting it unless I'm the one who's letting you get it. And then there was the science guy who he was on the plane. He's like, oh, that's a cute idea, but it's wrong. I'm the science guy. Everything I say is right. Ha ha ha. And like, that there was just a lot of those moments for me that were like, these are stereotypical cliches of characters and cliches of moments almost. Like there was a scene where there were the rookies who like you never met them. You saw their faces. They talked on the phone once or twice. But they, guess what? They're panicked and they don't believe in the scientists. So they're going to stage a coup. And it was... somehow that felt cliche. It felt, everything felt, there are a lot of times when it felt like it went in sequence, like it went in like a neatly plotted course of action, which you could tell from the right get-go. Like once you saw the first domino falling, you knew what was going to happen at the end of it.
Yes.
Which for better and worse, like, there were times when that was for better and there were times when that was for worse, you know?
Yeah, I think I agree with you a lot on that. And I think that
it might have been intentional in the film. Like,
yeah. Well, so what I'd be interested in is, are there any moments that jump out to you as where it was worked well versus where it didn't?
So I would say the rookie thing first off of you saw the military guy or rookie, he was listening to like a conspiracy video being like the government, the same ones who like bankrupted our military and failed our Medicaid program. You want them in charge?
Lovely little Rush Limbaugh comeback interplay right there.
That scene for me was like, okay, they are obviously going to do something. Like that was hitting the hammer on the head. That was like, okay, that's very clear what's going to come of this.
Oh, that's interesting, because that was one of the ones that I totally missed on that. Like, I saw that happening and did not, like, I was surprised by the bomb. And it actually took me a while to understand what was happening for the bomb scene. Like I didn't grok it until like partway through. Though I totally agree with you, I think, on the general point you're making and a lot of other examples. Sure. That was one where I was like, oh, it took me a while to understand what was happening and I didn't see that one coming.
Okay. Well, fair.
But I think it's fair. I think it's totally a fair point.
There's a lot of like, oh, the obvious, like, oh, humans are afraid of the aliens and there's just the sense of like, okay, the main character, no one's going to listen to her. And then she does this crazy weird thing. Like, what is she like writing her name? Or she's writing human on a chalkboard. That's such a stupid idea. Like, oh, how could you think of doing that, you idiot main character person? And then, oh, lo and behold, it works. And it's just like, okay, like, it's like, oh, she's going to take off. She's going to take off her suit. It's like, oh, what do we do? Do we abort? Do we get out of there? It's like, no, it's fine. Everything's going to be fine now. And
yeah.
Just those kind of things where it's their story cliches that are they're cliches, and like I just roll my eyes. I roll my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is part of I've been trying to wrestle with it, I guess, a little bit since seeing it yesterday. But this movie, to me, it feels like, I don't want to say it feels like two different movies, but it definitely is a movie that. You think you're watching one movie, and then by the time you're done with it, especially in the last like 20 minutes, but then I think arguably even like once the movie is over, you realize you were actually watching a different movie. And not in the way, because I guess arguably we'll talk more about it as we actually walk through the plot. But like it's a twist movie sort of, but it's not a twist movie in the sense of like a Shyamalan movie where it's, which I like plenty of them, to be clear, but where it's, oh, you're still watching the same kind of movie, but now there's just this other thing that colors it. Like, I guess Sixth Sense is that classic example of like, it's still, you know, the fact that, spoiler alert, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time, it elevates and heightens the movie, but it doesn't fundamentally change it from being this kind of ghost story, melancholic ghost story movie. That it was going to be anyway. In this case, the again, we're in the spoiler section, twist that, oh, all of those flashbacks are actually flash forwards, and that she is experiencing time in a different way than anyone else does, or the way that we expect time to work in movies, that recontextualizes the movie for me at least, of being like, oh, I thought that I was watching a movie that was this very elevated good version of a sort of cliched, we need to like interact with the aliens, and especially in context of like basically every Denis Villeneuve movie has the theme of like violence begets violence, you have to break the cycle of violence. And like that was extremely clear in this one. So like that's the movie I thought I was watching, was a, here's the linguist that's going to go and try and break this cycle of violence before it can start. And it's going to be use all those cliches, but it's going to at least technically do them well, that you're sort of like, all right, this is fun and I enjoy it. And then in fact, it's a movie. It's a movie about like, okay, if you knew your entire future, would you make the choice to go through with it? And like, would you change anything differently? And it's like, okay, I was watching a different movie and I didn't realize it until the end. And I kind of want to watch it again. So that, wait, I think
I'm starting to realize what this movie is as you're saying this. What? Wait, what?
Oh, wait. Okay. So hold on, pause. So what do you think?
So you said their flashbacks are all actually flash forwards, right?
Yeah.
But first off, From what context? Like, from where?
Okay.
From what?
So what do you think the... Pause. Explain to me... quick walkthrough. Explain to me the story of Arrival as you understand it.
Okay, so from the beginning of the movie, aliens arrive, and then she goes, and they start to talk, and they start to uncover their language, and then eventually, through uncovering of the language, she discovers, time travel in a sense, kind of kind of where she basically can go, she can visit almost any point in time of her life, kind of, but needs to also visit it in order to like learn information, which is kind of confusing of the concept of where the information comes from, but ignoring that, I don't know, she can see her entire life like on a page basically, right? She can read the whole book.
Yes. Okay. So that is, yes, I think that is correct. And actually, I've also read the Wikipedia page and stuff like that. So I think then the one other thing is that she does not have a daughter in the real time part of the story. She has not had her daughter yet. It's her and Jeremy Renner hook up together. I think the implication is it's the day that they leave is the day that they first start hooking up, and then they get married. They have the kid. They have the kid. She knows that the kid is going to die. When she tells Jeremy Renner this, that's when Jeremy Renner leaves, because he's like, wait, you knew she was going to die, but you still went through with having her anyway. And
oh,
that's
my God.
When she says, when she remember, she has the scene with the daughter, and it's like, oh, he left because like he said I made the wrong choice or something like that. My read of it, at least, that's what the choice was. It was the choice to still have the daughter, even though you know the daughter's going to die when she's a teenager.
Okay, so I thought she named her second daughter Hannah, and I was like, that's kind of fucked up. Like,
yeah.
Like, why would you name your second daughter the same as your first daughter? Oh, my God.
It's only one. And all of the – and so that that is a big part of why I think I, like, went from liking this movie. Again, I was coming at it from the exact same perspective you did.
Oh,
like,
okay. That's so much cooler now.
Like, it's kind of cliched, but it's a very good I guess I'll keep talking about other – because I watched them all in a week – other Denis Villeneuve films that, like, reminds me of, like – so Prisoners is this movie with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal that's – Hugh Jackman's daughter gets kidnapped or goes missing, I guess, spoilers, and then Jake Gyllenhaal is the cop who's trying to find her, and it's like, oh, this is a good you know, it's kind of a schlocky B movie, but it's just a very technically well executed version of it. And I kind of felt the same way about Sicario. I actually didn't like Sicario as much as the other movies, but I was like, okay, it's a sort of war as hell. Here's some cops, morally corrupt cops that are, you know, fighting drug war, stuff like that. But it's like a very technically competently well made version. That's kind of what I thought Arrival was okay. You know, competent, well-made version of this Close Encounters of the Third Kind movie. Yeah, it's hitting the cliche beats, but at least it, you know, it's well acted, it's well shot, it's well scored.
Yeah.
Fun.
Okay. I like it a lot more now. Okay.
In my head, and this might be a reach, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a reach, but I could see people saying, wait, fuck that, that's dumb, or it not being enough to make them like it. It, for me, the fact that particularly the flashbacks and that intro scene, it so uses the language of these movies to, like, you every single person watching this movie, I guarantee, has the exact thing of like what you said. Oh, not only is this a thing that happened before the main story started, because that's how linear time works in movies, but it's for the exact purpose you talked about. It's so that we have an understanding of her sense of loss that will drive rest of the movie. And it, like, it's shot and it's edited to feel like that, and then it turns out no, in fact it's not, but it also is, because she's perceiving time differently once she gets to the end of the movie. So it is a sense of loss that is driving her, but it's driving her despite the fact that it hasn't happened yet. And, like, it mind bends this whole thing together, and it uses those cliches to be able to pull off the magic trick of oh, the flashbacks are actually flash forwards.
Okay. First off, upgrade from A- to A+, or to A.
Hell yeah.
because now I understand, how could I have thought? Okay. See, that's so interesting.
The reason you would have thought it is because you know how to watch movies, and the language of how movies works. Yeah. Like, you've been watching movies for 26 years of your life. Well, maybe not 26. I don't know. Whatever. You've been watching movies for 20 years. You understand how movies are supposed to work. Even there's even a grammar to how we do flashbacks. And this plays with it. Again, I could understand people being like, still, that didn't do it enough for me, or like, you know, it's too cheap that it plays with the flashbacks in order to do blah blah blah, whatever. Fair arguments, and
I mean,
and also I think people just don't. There are a lot of people. I was chatting with a friend, Benina, earlier this week, who just, like, bounce off of his filmmaking style more. And so, like, all fair, but for me, that's what works so well, is that, like, oh, it uses your understanding of how film works against you, but then to tell you a beautiful story that breaks your brain, that's great.
I think, first off, I mean, I think it's just a me thing, unfortunately, of, like, the fact that I didn't get that the end of the movie was it was actually the same child the entire time. It wasn't a separate daughter. Unfortunately, it was just me. So I kind of wish I had that experience, that dawning moment. Because again, the cliche, I groaned at the ending of the movie. Like I audibly groaned because I was like, oh, why do they have to add in a love story to this? Why do they have to add in the two main characters falling in love now? And like now I'm seeing why they had to do that. They absolutely had to do that because if they wouldn't have, then that wouldn't have made, it's like, oh, if you want science, go ask your dad, which is one of the lines, listeners, by the way. And it's like, oh, that makes so much more sense now that like that is so that. OK, so I'm still a little bit complaining about some of the cliches that were in the movie. Yeah, I do think like you can use the cliche. The beginning cliche was fine. And like even though I was thinking academically about it, I was on board with it because it was like, OK, sure, this is so stereotypical, but it does what it does. And then talking about what you were saying about the playing with cliches.
And also, like, you get one of the, like, you get a few of those in every movie, especially if it's a sci-fi movie. So, like, fine. It works. There's
cliches
a reason.
Cliches for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, and then that would have also been neatly mirrored by the end cliche, which is also fine because of the fact of this. It's no longer cliche if you're using it for telling a time travel story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? Oh, that's so cool. That's beautiful. I'm upset that I didn't realize it in the movie now. Oh.
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. I guess, hey, like the movie Arrival, we're talking about the ending before we actually talked really much about anything.
Does it really matter, though?
What's the line? If you could, if you saw your whole life, would you do anything differently or something like that? While we're on the nitpick subject, or while we were close to the nitpick subject, the main thing that bothers me about the movie is like, I wish Jeremy Renner had more to do, I wish he had more to do, whether that was him, like, you know, we see him understand more linguistics and contribute more, or ideally, I kind of would have loved it. It's like they do set up at the beginning, cliched, but like they set up the science guy and she's the linguistics person. Linguistics is a science, but whatever. I would have loved if there was a moment where like, okay, and here is where his physics helped save the day. It kind of was that in the like, oh, he uses the negative space thing to figure out that it's 1/12 and blah, blah, blah. But I'm like,
it's not that much. Like,
yeah, like you don't have to be a genius in physics.
That was his job. Like, that was his job. That was not his genius. Yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah, I feel a little bit more okay about it, given that how many movies have you seen where the gender roles are reversed and they're like, oh, this person who is the genius physicist who is really just there to mostly be arm candy and to like help out a couple times and be like a romantic lead. It's like, okay, Jeremy Renner is playing a slightly better version of that character that we've seen 100,000 times, but usually it's the woman that does that. So I'm not like mad about it, but I'm like, you know, it was right there. He could have done some science.
Which it's annoying and it's like frustrating, but I also don't think like that's not the point of the movie. The point of the movie isn't a character analysis. It isn't about the script or, I don't know, the story really, you know, it's about this concept. And also something we haven't talked about at all is just the simple awe-inspiring nature of the movie. Like the amount of times where they're like staring at this like gaseous pane of glass with the aliens behind them and they're trying to, it just inspires a sense of awe in you that I think the production did really, really well with.
Yeah, I mean, that this movie is incredible production design, incredible cinematography, incredible score and sound design. Again, I'm gonna keep talking about all the other Denis Villeneuve movies I've watched. That is a thing with him, is that like he makes really fucking technically great movies, and has great collaborators. A lot of his other movies, not this one, but are shot by Roger Deakins, who is kind of well regarded as like, oh, he's the best living cinematographer. He shot Sicario, Blade Runner, the guy who won an Oscar for 1917 this year. This one is instead shot by Bradford Young, I want to say, who is also very good. So like it is not just technically well made, but definitely technically well made for that exact thing you're talking about, of like, it's there to inspire the sense of awe in the audience that you would feel if you were someone who had to deal with the fact that holy fucking shit, aliens just landed.
Yeah. Like, there's just a scene where they do the gravity shift into the alien ship. Yeah. Like, that scene maybe lasts like 5 minutes or so. And it was just of, oh my God, there's the gravity shifts in this part of the ship. And like the simple act of getting, like, jumping up and then landing on the ship sideways was something that was really meant to, like, inspire, like, oh my God, this is terrifying and amazing and cool, but, like, oh my God, this defies the laws of physics and life and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the design of everything, of like, oh, it's these big, you know, weird sort of like thumbprint cookie shaped giant black rocks that are floating in the sky.
Yeah.
And the aliens are these like weird tentacle things that are floating in goo. The one scene that I really like as a scene, but don't like, or kind of bounced off the visuals of it, the only scene of that was the one where she actually goes inside of the white space in the alien ship.
I love that scene.
I loved it as a scene. It's just that, like, and maybe it was that, like, you know, the compression on my TV or my internet or something like that, where I was like, oh, this looks more CGI than the rest of the movie did. And I bounced off that a little bit. However, it was a gorgeous, beautiful scene. And especially the what the fuck moment of, like, all of a sudden the subtitles come in and it's like, oh,
yeah,
she genuinely gets it and, like, is actually having a conversation and is able to, like, read and write the thing. I was like, oh. The scene I loved, the design look of it mostly was cool, especially seeing, like, oh, this is what the full alien looks like. But the it looked a little more CGI-ish, I think, than the rest of the movie did. And I kind of bounced off.
I think that was just your TV, your screen.
Totally possible.
Yeah. For me, that was a really cool, like, honestly, that was the only section of the movie where she actually struggled that late into the movie. Which I liked about that. She didn't know what to do.
It was a good Abed's death process.
Abbott and Costello was another roll my eyes like moment.
Oh yeah.
It's a cliche. Of course they're gonna be Abbott and Costello. Like, it's come on.
I felt like that rang true though. Like, that seems like the kind of shit a scientist would do. If you got like a physicist and a linguist, and like imagine Nat was in charge of like talking to aliens, and he's like, yeah, he would maybe not Abbott and Costello, but he'd like pick some two pop culture names to unknowable, yes, and at that point uncommunicable aliens.
Absolutely. But Abbott and Costello is just the most cliche possible option that there is. Like,
that's fair, which
felt like a lot of my moments in this movie were of that sensibility of like the domino being ticked over, and like, oh, you know where it's gonna go and you know what's gonna happen. There was just a lot of teeny cliches like that. Like, maybe I don't know, it just felt weird. It felt cookie cutter. It felt like the movie was cookie cutter but arranged in such a beautiful way that,
oh yeah, totally
cool time travel concept and like first contact concept, but
my take on it slightly different, that I agree with you on the cookie cutterness. What it felt like to me was that the movie was, if it was just, if there hadn't been a time travel twist, or the time travel twist hadn't displayed itself in like emotionally with the daughter story, yeah, I think it would have been, I would have felt like, okay, this is a movie where it's a lot of cliches, but it's technically well executed. Basically exactly what you said. What I kind of feel like now, and maybe this is just me making excuses for it because I loved the movie, but that it was more, the energy and the juice and the originality on the movie was so focused on this overall twist and story and structure that it's like everything else was like, okay, let's do the quick thing that will get the point across fast, exactly, rather than like, we're not going to spend time on putting a lot of energy, narrative energy, or maybe even just like time of the writer energy into these parts because the real shit's happening later.
Yes, which like in a year, maybe 2 years, I will not remember the faces of, I will not remember the actors in this movie.
Yeah.
Like I will barely remember a single line probably. I honestly, this movie, you could have used any actors. Like I didn't know Jeremy Renner was in the movie until I saw him. Like
that is also true. I didn't know that either. I didn't know about Jeremy Renner or Forest Whitaker being in the movie.
Yeah, that's so strange. Like they could have been replaced by anyone. The acting performances in this movie were like, they were okay. They were not important. Is my gist.
So that actually leads me to a question that I was going to ask is, I know you mentioned, I don't think it was on the podcast. I think it was just in a side conversation. You're not a big fan of Amy Adams.
No, I'm not. Yeah.
So what did you think about? So one, is there any reason behind that other than just like people don't like things for whatever reason? And sometimes the human brain is a mystery. Is there any like reason that you dislike her before? Two, then after that, what did you think about her in this movie?
Well, honestly, my opinion didn't really change too much about her. Because the reason why I don't really like her that much is I feel like she's kind of generic-ish. And I don't think I've ever seen, I cannot tell you a movie that I've seen. I don't remember any movie she's been in, honestly. Okay. Like I'm thinking right now of what movies is Amy Adams in, and I remember her having a Southern accent for some reason. Was she in Brokeback Mountain? She might have been.
I think that was Anne Hathaway. Well, okay. Rather, I know Anne Hathaway is in Brokeback.
I feel the same way about Anne Hathaway, honestly.
Okay.
So like, she just feels generic, and in this movie, her performance was as generic as it. You know, like it didn't need to be good. I'm not saying that like it hindered the performance of the movie or it added too much, frankly, but I don't know.
Okay.
My opinion kind of stayed the same.
Yeah. I respect your opinion, no matter how fucking batshit crazy it is. Amy Adams rules. And the fact that like to even further prove, not prove my point, but point out how on just totally different sides of the aisle we are on this one, is the fact that then you also called in Anne Hathaway. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Two of my favorite actors who I think are incredible. And he's doing some of my favorite performances. Okay, fun. Now, again,
I like her a little bit more. I feel like she's done some more things that I do enjoy, but
yeah. I'm dunking on you both because I find it actually crazy, but also because it's fun. Say like everyone has actors that just like they bounce off of for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Christian Slater's mine that I'm just like doesn't do it for me.
Yeah, that one's weird.
Yeah. And I don't know why. It's just like, nope, doesn't work. Even though I love Heathers, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. Fine. Amy Adams fucking rules in general. I mean, she's been in, I think there's been some movies where it's like, all right, yeah, you're fine. Nothing to write home about, but like, so good in Sharp Objects, so good in The Master, really fun in Enchanted. I think that was probably the first movie of hers that I saw. And I think really, really good in this movie.
Yeah.
Would I go so far as to say that like, she's the best person for this role or that I couldn't see someone else doing even more with this? No. And she's not certainly not like my number one of all time actor or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. The idea of this being correct me if I'm misunderstanding, but basically that like what you need is you need a competent person at the wheel in order, like the actors need to be just good at being actors, but you don't need much beyond that in order to make the movie work. Is that your take?
Yeah, exactly. Like they needed to be competent, like, yeah. And they were, and they're more than competent. They did a delightful, but that's not what it was about, you know.
I think I agree with that. I think I like Amy Adams. For me, this is like a unique and special performance from her. I totally though feel that way about like Forest Whitaker, Jeremy Renner, even Michael Stuhlbarg, love him to death. That's like, oh yeah, they are doing the work and it's good and not bringing anything extra special to the table. I do weirdly like Jeremy Renner a lot. He's sort of the opposite of my Christian Slater of just like, it's not that you're actually doing a great job. It's just for whatever reason, I like it.
Yeah. Something I wanted to talk about in this movie was time travel.
Yeah.
Because
yeah, you've got opinions.
I have so many opinions about time travel. And in fact,
episode one of the A-Dub Club podcast, where you could be your own grandfather, wherein we talked about the question, is time travel a lazy plot device?
Yeah. And this movie has so much time travel in it that it is qualified as a time travel movie. Absolutely. So first off, I did have a interview last Monday, which I did not get, unfortunately. But I gave a presentation. They said give a presentation on a technical topic, and my topic of choice was actually time travel in fiction and why it's, you know, can be good, can be bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was very fun to do, even though I didn't get the job, motherfuckers. But time travel in this movie. The way how this movie works, it does a single timeline. I don't know if it's a causal reality or causal effect. Like it's unclear if it can affect it.
It's less that it's time travel and more that it's time perception.
Yeah.
But then it's like,
I would qualify it as time travel. Absolutely.
Well, what I was going to say is like, is there a difference between the two? And one, is there a difference at all? But also, is there a difference in a world where, like, literally, they're like, how would us as audience members or the human or people think about a non-linear perception of time? It just like, it just doesn't. Is there any way we could even think about it without thinking about it through our lens of linear time?
Yeah, that's and, it's no, I think is the answer.
yeah.
I first off want to say the time travel in this movie was fantastic, and story-wise, it told the story, and it, especially with that new revelation of that the daughter at the very end, it did an amazing job on all accounts in plot and storytelling and fiction. But
okay, there's the but.
In terms of technical application of time travel, there's one minor flaw. So when she learns from the general his secret number, and then his wife's dead words that she tells him years earlier. That is something that couldn't technically happen per se, because unless you only have one person who can ever travel through time. Because she actually changed the effects of what happened, right? In order to get something done, in order to prevent China from bombing the crap out of the enemy ship, she had to go to a point in time where they didn't bomb the crap out of them, get his phone number, and then call that phone number at the other point in time, right? But let's say you had two people who could do that, right? And she fundamentally changed her timeline, right? She did something that changed.
I think some of this also rests on the idea, maybe even the version of it that makes sense is more extreme, though also potentially the way the real world works, who knows? Sure. That it's like, it works if it's not only. If we live in a non-causal universe where it's like everything happens and it all happened at once and we perceive it in one direction and perceive if causality is an illusion, essentially, then it works because she wasn't actually making any decision or wasn't actually changing anything because everything happened the way it happened and all arguably happened at once, but throughout a dimension that we call time that doesn't actually have any real causal influence on each other. That is, however, one, a thorny subject in the subject of moral philosophy, which I wrote many papers on in my various moral philosophy classes. Two, equally fucking crazy for any person to think about because, like, our perception of time and our perception of causality works in one direction and is so ingrained in the entire way that we think about everything. So,
Yes, I don't think that would work though. Because she would have to. I don't know, that brings up too many issues in terms of free will and like
yes, 100% under this this thing, what is it, it's the, I guess it's just called the free will debate, but basically it is the argument that there, yes, there is no such thing as free will, that like everything happens and
it's like her choice. And, she could have chosen not to have done it, right?
Yeah, well, not in a world where you assume that there is no causality, or that everything is predetermined. Yeah, this is an extremely thorny question. Literally, this is what I wrote the papers on. And yeah, again, this was like a college 201 class, so I'm not saying that I'm an expert in any of this. And it was also like 4 or 5 years ago. But yeah, it's basically that argument of it's coming at it from the perspective of, if we assume from physics that things are deterministic, and based on that, we assume that everything that happens and there's no way to change that, which then based on that, can we assume there's any concept of free will? And then based on the idea that there isn't any free will, can we assign any morality to it? It's a lot. I have a fun textbook that you could read about it, that I need to reread because I forget most of it. But anyway, that's a valid, weird, thorny thing to say, that like, if nothing can be changed, does anyone have free will? And a answer to that, which is kind of the answer that I lean towards, which is why I also kind of don't know if I think free will actually exists in the real world, is that no, but what else are we going to do if this is how we perceive the world? It's like, all right. Also, we wouldn't even have the free will to choose to not think about things in terms of free will because we don't have free will. So whatever.
It's complicated is what I'm getting.
Okay. Again, that's why I jumped into it saying like the way that I think it makes sense to me raises so many other questions.
Yeah. I guess I reject the premise of causality not being a functional way that we exist. I believe in a causal world, I guess.
And I do think that there's an element of in terms of how this story is structured, in terms of the stuff they're talking about, it's like basically that is the incompatibility, or requires lots of brain twisting in order to try and make anything compatible, is the, this movie functions on the way that it thinks about time, functions on the idea that like these creatures can perceive all of time as happening at once. And then the other thing, which is not true, but whatever, it's fun because it's a movie, is that okay, by learning there, like there's some element of that like saber wharf hypothesis that's like kind of true, but like what the hypothesis means, so in the movie they talk about the saber wharf hypothesis. It's this idea that the way you understand language impacts your cognition. And it is kind of true, but like the level to which it is true is on the level of, oh, if you have more words for different colors of blue, it's easier for you to perceive different colors of blue. It is not, had not been proven out at all at the level of like anything greater than that. And certainly not at the level of, if you have a non-linear language,
you can time travel.
See all of time.
So here, for example, here's my issue with that kind of concept of, so at the very beginning of the movie, she learned about time travel. And she was flashing forward to her daughter's life, right? I guess this is probably getting more into the effects of causality, I guess, is why I don't believe in it. Of like, oh, if she existed at a time when she's thinking about her daughter, then at that point in time, she will have already seen the aliens, technically. Right?
Yeah. I mean, so my read of the story, and I think some of this is like, now, I think this movie gets the linguistics pretty right.
It's complicated.
Yeah, this movie gets the linguistics pretty right, and apparently there's a lot of like linguists that consulted on the movie, which is cool. Though that's the other thing that I'm fine with it, because the movie, I thought it was a movie about linguistics, and then it turns out it's actually not a movie about linguistics. So in retrospect, I'm fine with it. While I was watching it, I was like, wait, you only gave us like a couple scenes of linguistics. Now you're going to montage through all the cool shit, all the stuff that I wanted to watch. It was fine because, again, it's not actually a movie about linguistics. It just feels like it from the first time you watch it. It gets the linguistics part right. The rest of it is like very, you know, not – this is not Alistair Reynolds. This is like,
which is fine.
We're going to start a hand wave and we're going to run with it. My read of the movie, basically, what would your life be like if you not only – like these aliens, they presumably from birth can understand or see their entire timeline, Whereas for Amy Adams, it's like over the course of this movie, she's able to do it. And so that's why things are a little weird and fuzzy. Yeah. But it's definitely like sort of hand wavy. And it leans more towards how do we make these moments work for the structure of the story than how do we make this logically the way that we like.
Fine.
And I think it's trying to sort of get that like you're gradually learning. So it's like she can't pull the true magic trick of, hey, she's learning things as they're happening, but it's hand wavy and it's story based rather than like the science of being able to see your entire timeline.
Yeah, it's yeah, exactly. Which is fine for the story. Yeah, one tiny last thing that I want to talk about was kind of not so much about the quality of the movie or whatever, but of the morality of having her daughter.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't know how I would come to that decision. That'd be very hard to do. So first off, two issues of kind of going back to the time travel and causality of did she have a choice to have the daughter or not because she had already had the daughter?
I was going to say the cop-out answer that I kind of believe but is not fun for the purpose of this conversation is that like, she had no choice. And if she had no choice, does morality exist anyway? And if morality doesn't exist, who cares? That is a valid part of philosophy moral philosophy if I don't cut out my long rant about it earlier, but for the purpose of this conversation it's a cop-out, so whatever.
So let's say ignoring that part, is that something that is morally, I don't know, good to do? Like,
yeah,
and if it's not okay to do that, then what is the limit? Like, if they're gonna have a car accident at 20 or at 45, maybe, is that a bad thing? If they get cancer when they're 70, is that a good amount of time for life to have lived in order to be morally okay for them to, you have chosen to give birth to them? Is having the responsibility and the knowledge of when they're going to die make you responsible for choosing when they, you know, whether or not to give birth to them?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, also sort of cop out, the argument of the movie, I feel like, is yes, it is, in fact, a correct moral decision. Personally, I don't know, and I kind of lean towards, yeah, I think that is a reasonable moral choice to make that, I get it, I guess it sort of hinges on the, is it better to, it is the joy worth the pain? Is it better to live at all than to not live, or to yeah. and then both the like the joy of the kid's life versus the pain of the ending of it, as well as the joy of her life having the kid be in her life versus the what'll presumably be terrible pain of the
child
daughter dying, as well as also the like knock-on pain of like, oh, she's gonna lose her husband. But then same sort of question you could ask is like, is it right to get into the relationship with him if she knows that not only is the kid gonna die but he's gonna leave once he knows that she tells her about knowing the future?
Yeah.
And then should she tell him about the future knowing that he's going to leave once she does it? And I like, again, her view very clearly seems to be, and I think the view of the movie is, yes, better to
love and lost, never
better to have lived and lost. Yeah. Literally.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I lean to, I think.
Okay. But, well, I'm gonna push back on that then. Let's go in the opposite direction. Yeah. What if they die in childbirth? Or what if they die, if that's too short of time, what if they die in when they're 5 years old?
Interesting.
What if they die at a month old? What's your barometer? Do you have one?
I mean, in that specific case, because I'm also thinking this is thorny and risky for the two white guys to talk about on podcast. If I'm also thinking through my feelings on like abortion and things like that, I guess it's the like, are they a viable conscious or are they like a conscious living? Terminology.
No, this isn't about that. No, this isn't about potential for them.
No. But here's what I'm thinking about: is like because I feel that there is.
It's all potential.
Yeah. Sure. What I'm thinking about is like it's.
This is the new governmental legislation act of when everyone can perceive all of time. Does the government legislate that no, you can't have a child if they are going to die at under a month old?
Well, this, I mean, I, again, a thorny question.
Yeah. So like,
the difference between this and stuff like concerns around prenatal genetic testing and things like that is basically that, but with the difference of certainty. But the only difference between the two of those, and granted, it's not an insignificant difference, but it's basically, it's like a probabilistic difference of, in those cases, you're saying there is a probability they will have this disease and die a terrible death early versus I know for a fact that they will do this. But then even that, now that I'm saying that out loud, I'm like, well, I guess I'm more okay with the idea of like, you know, your kid's going to die a terrible death and be like, you know, they might be born totally non-viable, or they'll have a terrible, painful death that like starts from the moment they are, or they'll live their whole life in pain for 10 years, something like that. Where it's like, that's a case where in the context of the like prenatal genetic testing, I lean a little bit more towards like, well, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. I still, or okay, rather, here's what I'm going to say. Here's what I'm going to say. Because now that I'm actually thinking about it, it's not that I don't think it's immoral for her to have the kid.
Okay.
I also, though, wouldn't, I don't think I would think it was immoral for her to say, I don't want it.
Yeah.
That basically, like, I don't think it's a choice with one moral answer and one immoral answer. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think I'm coming at it from the lens of what is my own moral philosophy around like abortion and things like that is definitely coloring my opinion of this case.
I think to some extent, eventually it does become a moral question, it's kind of like around abortion, right? Like you can't abort a child that's born, then it becomes murder, right? It's kind of the start of, where the line starts to bleed. It's a very hard question. I'm glad I don't have to answer.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad that one, we don't have to answer it, both because who cares about our opinions on this stuff?
Sure.
Two, it's a movie. It doesn't exist. We don't actually have to make that decision.
We can't perceive all of time. What?
I know, right? It's interesting. It's interesting. But I guess that's sort of where I end up is that I do think it's a valid, defensible moral choice to have the kid, but I don't think that means the choice to clearly Jeremy Renner would have made a different choice, and yeah. I don't think he's immoral either for that being the choice he would have made if he was in that situation.
Yeah.
Everyone's right. Yay.
Yay.
Everyone's right and everyone's sad. the one other thing that I want to talk about on this movie specifically, and then I have some more meta takes on the state of science fiction in the 2010s, I decided to watch not all of, but so what did I watch? I watched Polytechnique, which is his 2009 French Canadian film, really, really good. This one I liked a lot. Black and white film about the L'École Polytechnique massacre in Montreal in the 80s. Very, very tense, but also kind of beautiful and meditative thriller movie. I saw Prisoners, the one that I talked about already with Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman, crime movie. Enemy, another movie with Jake Gyllenhaal. That is, Jake Gyllenhaal plays a like sad sack history professor who discovers a third-rate out-of-work actor who looks exactly like him. And so Jake Gyllenhaal plays two Jake Gyllenhaals, and it's great. Sicario, and then I had seen Blade Runner 2049 before, and again, I liked Polytechnic a lot, but the other ones that I was watching, I was like, oh, these are fine. And my big take on it was just like, he feels like maybe it's just that he's a really good in the moment director and really good at like technically creating scenes that, you know, get me through a movie. But I end the movie being like, I was entertained watching that, but don't leave feeling moved in any way, real way, shape or form. Maybe shocked, maybe surprised, maybe I'm thinking about things, enemy especially, but like, maybe he's just a good in the moment director and but it's kind of empty other than that. And then was worried because like, I haven't seen Blade Runner 2049 in like 3 years and I remember loving it, but you know, maybe I was wrong about it. Yeah. Now that I'm looking back on it, the fact that I loved Blade Runner 2049 and loved Arrival, I do think Arrival was a better movie than like Prisoners and Enemy and whatever. But the real thing I've discovered, or my theory now, is that, I think I am actually correct about that he's a really good in the moment director. The difference is when he makes movies where like his big idea that all the just like in the moment technical competency is serving. Yeah. If I'm really interested in the topic and in the ideas that he's talking about, then cool. I fucking love it. And so the two movies that I like are Blade Runner 2049, which is all about like artificial intelligence and the like morality of like sentience and consciousness, which was half of what my major was in college. And then this movie is all about linguistics and the question about like free will, all the stuff we just discussed about like free will and choice and morality when you perceive time in a non-linear, non-causal way. And I'm like, oh, if he just makes the movies that are about my major in college, then I fucking love it. And if he makes movies about anything else, I'm like, that was a fun, solid time with the movies, Denny. But I leave feeling, you know, it's like, yep, that was a nice B plus kind of thing. So that is my grand theory on Denis Villeneuve's filmography, is that he just needs to keep making movies about my major and I will love it.
That's good. That's good.
Anything else on the movie itself?
No, I think I'm good.
So then the one other thing I want to talk about is we were sort of like texting back and forth. I mean, I think we both agreed, especially after last episode and the last couple episodes, we want to do something that's like, back to our roots. We want to watch some like fucking movie and talk about it. And it was interesting, like you in particular were talking about like, oh, I want to watch like a good, I want to watch a fucking sci-fi movie. And was there any particular reason other than you just fucking like sci-fi that was what was like you were jonesing for?
Yeah. Netflix had recommended me to watch Blade Runner, the original OG Blade Runner. And so I was like, you know, I wanted to watch that, and I wanted a good excuse to watch it. And then I was also like, you know, I could also watch some new stuff that I haven't seen yet. And Arrival popped up.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because we were talking about that, and I think we were talking about like, okay, we watched Blade Runner, we watched 2001 or something like that. I had seen 2001 recently. My spicy take is I don't really like it. It's influential, whatever, fine. And before you at me and be like, the last time I saw it, which was right before the pandemic, it was literally in a movie. It was in a movie theater on 70mm, like the perfect way to see 2001. And I still was like, yeah, the middle hour is really cool, but the rest of it's fine. Anyway, and then, yeah, so I was sort of looking up, like, what are the – because you were also – you wanted to watch something or were interested in watching something new.
Yeah.
And so I was looking up, like –
there's something classic or something new that I hadn't seen yet, you know? Like
– yeah. And so we're looking up, like, oh, what are some of the great new science fiction movies? And so I was looking through best science fiction movies of the top 10 last 10 years, and – Under the Skin shows up a lot, or Her, or Interstellar, or Inception, or Ex Machina, or Mad Max, or Edge of Tomorrow. Like those are all movies that like will show up on all of those. But then another one that just kept coming up, like basically it was, if you looked at any of these top 10 lists of the decade, it's either do they have Mad Max as the top sci-fi movie of the decade, or do they have Arrival as the top one? And neither of us had seen it. And it's like, all right, fuck, we want to see it. So all of that to say, do you think Arrival is one of, or potentially the best sci-fi movie of the last 10 years?
I would say it's definitely one of. I don't know if it definitely cracks my top 10. I don't know if it's my top 5, but it's very, yes, absolutely. It's one of the best sci-fi movies of the past 10 years.
Nice. I think I would agree with that. It's hard because like, when I'm thinking through It's a lot of stuff that I would put at the top are like horror movies that might have a sci-fi tint to them, or I don't watch as much pure sci-fi as I think that you do.
Yep.
But yeah, definitely this is way up there. I need to also rewatch Mad Max Fury Road because I remember liking it but not loving it as much as everyone else did when I first saw it, and I think I'm probably wrong about that.
I rewatched it again recently, and it was everything that it was the first time I saw it.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Nice.
It's actually called Furiosa Fury Road. Shirley Crone Fury Road.
Indeed. I did also watch Edge of Tomorrow yesterday for the first time. That was the other one that I pitched, which you'd seen a million times. Yeah.
Still it was love good. That.
It was good. Nice. Yeah. Arrival. It's a good film. You should watch it, especially if you've listened to us talk for an hour about it and spoil the shit out of it. But that's okay because, hey, you can perceive, that'll be interesting to rewatch the movie now knowing the ending. And hey, we'll be perceiving all of time at once. And we just like, maybe it's actually a movie about watching movies and the experience of having watched. If you perceive time in a nonlinear fashion, therefore you've already heard me say this years and years ago. In fact, you already have done this. We thank you for the fact that you've already emailed us at theawclub@gmail.com. That's theawclub@gmail.com. Also a huge thank you for the fact that you've already tweeted at us and followed us on Twitter at theawclub. That's theawclub. Again, a huge thank you for the fact that you have already, because you perceive time in a nonlinear way, subscribe to us wherever you find podcasts. That's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. And again, huge thank you. Can't thank you enough for the fact that you visited the theadub.club, theadub.club, specifically our topics guide, where you can, where you have already found all of our episodes where we talk about various different topics, like in this case, the movie Arrival, reviews of sci-fi, and this, interesting, we'll have another one that goes in our time travel bucket, which I guess is a spoiler, but whatever. It's fine because you've already seen the movie and you perceive time in a nonlinear way, so you already knew that.
That's funny.
And with that, I think that is everything.
A-Dub Club out.
A-Dub Club out.
Yeah.
Okay, who are my 2016 actresses? Annette Bening in 20th Century Woman, Imogen Poots in Green Room, Hailee Steinfeld in Edge of 17, Emma Stone in La La Land, Anya Taylor-Joy in The Witch. Okay, I wouldn't knock any of them out for Amy Adams. Maybe Imogen Poots would be the most on the edge, but Green Room is so fucking good, and she's really good in it. But that's also an incredible year. Hailee Steinfeld, Emma Stone, Anya Taylor-Joy, Annette Bening. I mean, that's a year right there. So better luck next time, Amy Adams, in my fake fantasy Google spreadsheet.
No, that's good.